You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa. No mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Sanat. Ewha Akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about former Prime Minister Helen Clark's comments on Israel obstructing aid to Gaza, the recent Taxpayers Union Courier poll, and changes to electorate boundaries and names for the next election. For International Desk, I spoke to Assistant Professor in Journalism at Mount Royal University, Gabriella Podomo-Paez, about Israel's targeted attacks on Palestinian journalists. Sanat, what have you got for us today?
For city councilling this week, I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about the city rail link and building infrastructure in Auckland more generally. I also managed to have a conversation with Dental for All campaigner Hannah Pilkington-Ching about their new national roadshow and what their campaign is trying to achieve. I also managed to have a conversation with Dr. Gabriel McDonald from the University of Otago about the new GP funding formula announced by the government and how it neglects to include ethnicity data.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e ware ware I ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero ano, he pakehere rokiroki mārongi I te pai, tukutuku o irarangi poho, mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party.
Former Prime Minister Helen Clark recently visited the border of Gaza with Egypt. She visited as a member of the Elders, a non-profit made up of former world leaders that was founded by Nelson Mandela in 2007. She told the media that the Elders had taken the position that there was an unfolding genocide in Gaza and Israel was deliberately obstructing aid. Clark also said there was no reason why Aotearoa New Zealand shouldn't take the steps to recognise a Palestinian state. The latest Taxpayers Union Courier poll has predicted a hung parliament next election. Labour has overtaken National, with both National leader Christopher Luxon and Labour leader Chris Hipkins up in the preferred Prime Minister poll. And the Independent Representation Commission has announced the changes to electorates in time for the next general election. While the changes focus on adjusting boundaries, the electorate of Rongotai was also renamed to Wellington Bays. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about all of these issues. I started by asking if he supported Helen Clark speaking up about Israel obstructing aid to Gaza.
Absolutely. I've been on the ground in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland, attended the rallies in support of our whānau in Gaza. And Labour's called on the government to use every lever that it possibly has to put pressure on the Israeli government to end the unfolding genocide that we're seeing and the famine in Gaza.
So does the New Zealand government need to be taking a stronger stance on Palestine?
Absolutely. We've seen them come very slow to the mark, up to the mark on this particular item. They've got to put aside its divisions and immediately recognise the state of Palestine, in my view.
Why do you think our leaders have been so quiet on Palestine?
Well, they've been quiet on a number of things during their 2 years in government, and I think they've really let New Zealanders down. Things are getting worse. They're not standing up for the things that New Zealanders want them to, and this is one other example.
Is there more New Zealand can do than just recognising the Palestinian state and joining South Africa's international court case, for example?
There is, and I think speaking up and standing for what's right is the most important thing at this very time. But Chris Hipkins has said that if Labor was re-elected next year, that will invite the head of the General Delegation of Palestine to present their credentials as an ambassador to New Zealand. You know, action like that is really important. That's what we stand for and that's what we want to see from the government.
Do you think the results from the latest Taxpayers Union Kiria poll are a positive sign for Labor?
I think it's very encouraging. I come from the school that we've got a lot of work to do to build confidence with voters. Next year we'll get our policy out, but our role at the moment is to hold this government to account. Things are getting worse, not better. We're seeing a lack of leadership from Prime Minister Christopher Luxon, you know, and our focus will be on jobs, health, homes, and actually getting some real action on the cost of living.
Are you at all concerned about the potential impact of the Greens taking up media space as the main opposition on Labor's polling?
I support our cousins in the Greens and what they stand for. I think every party has the right to put their best foot forward. Ultimately, the voters will decide. But one of the things that I'm conscious of is we've got to offer a stable alternative. And, you know, that's what New Zealanders will vote for.
When can we expect Labor to start campaigning next year? Like, the Greens have already announced policies. Can we expect that from Labor anytime soon?
Well, the Tāmaki Makaurau by-election has given us a great opportunity to start campaigning hard in Auckland. It's been great, particularly to be out in South and West Auckland and amongst our markets and on the ground with our whānau. People are responding to that really well. And so, you know, we'll continue that momentum into the general election.
Are you supportive of the changes to electorates, particularly the name change of Rongotai to Wellington Bays?
I'm an advocate of Te Reo Māori. I enjoy seeing us shift from using Pākehā English names into Māori. But, you know, as we've seen with this government, they are taking us backwards, and that does include with Te Reo Māori too.
Are you concerned this could set a precedent for future electorate name changes?
Well, we'll see what the general election delivers next year. Labor has always increased the use of Te Reo Māori. We want, you know, more people in Aotearoa New Zealand speaking Te Reo Māori. That's our commitment. And so that's the way forward in my view. And I encourage, you know, as I think New Zealanders want us to use as much Te Reo Māori as possible.
Would you change the name of Wellington Bays back to Rongotai then?
That's probably not a decision for me, but, you know, I enjoy calling Auckland Tāmaki Makaurau. I put in a submission myself to change the name of the electorate of Northcote to Kaipātiki, not only because it was a Māori name, but also it's a more inclusive name that represents our wider community in that electorate.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on former Prime Minister Helen Clark's comments on Israel and Palestine, the recent Taxpayers Union Kiria poll, and changes to electorate boundaries and names for the next election.
That was the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone. Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Last week, several politicians, including the Prime Minister and the Mayor of Auckland, attended Auckland City Rail Link test run. As the project nears completion, the CRL team is busy running tests to ensure this new, upgraded rail system is ready for use on an unspecified date in 2026. Several political leaders were invited to this test last week, where they went through the three new stations that are a part of New Zealand's first underground rail system. This comes at a time where central government is becoming increasingly standoffish with local governments across the country, with the rhetoric aimed at focusing councils on, quote, roads, rubbish, and rates. This has come to a head with a recent move to introduce a rates cap, which threatens to put a hard ceiling on what local councils can spend on in their communities. The City Rail Link has been under construction for nearly a decade and costs more than $5.5 billion, with the project going over budget and over schedule on multiple occasions, drawing criticism from those who believe we're spending too much on ineffective infrastructure projects. I talked to Councillor Julie Ferry today about the value that CRL will give to the city and why we have such a hard time nationally and locally building ambitious infrastructure projects. Well, so Julie, last week there was a major test of the City Rail Link system, and I just wanted you to maybe give us a little bit of insight into the City Rail Link project and what it sort of promises for Auckland in terms of economic opportunity.
$5.5 billion, which is a massive amount of money. Several times it's had to have new money injected to make sure it can meet all its outcomes, and then because of, unfortunately, COVID delays, which created another need for some more funding. But since COVID, it's actually run pretty much on track in terms of timing, which is pretty impressive. And it's going to basically mean that the trains that currently meet a dead end in Britomart and then have to back out again can now go through and join up again. And so we're effectively sort of rejigging some of our main train lines to be through the city centre rather than dead end at the city centre. And it's going to mean pretty much a doubling of capacity for the number of trains we can run through the inner parts of our train system, which is just huge. It's also building several new stations. So Te Waihorotiu, which is directly opposite the council HQ on Albert Street, just up the hill a little bit from the Civic on Queen Street. That's going to be a brand new station, which is likely to become the busiest in the country. And it's going to revitalise that Midtown area, which has been quite downgraded by a lack of private investment, but also a whole lot of public and private construction that's been happening in the area. People who go up and down that portion of Wellesley Street, just outside the station, will be aware there's been this ongoing, just like feels like forever, of what's actually a water project. And that will be finished soon. The CRL station will open sometime next year. We're going to see quite a big change in that part of town. And then obviously there's the new station at Karanga Ahaipe as well, which is looking beautiful on the outside. There's been upgrades to Britomart, which will be renamed Waitemata. That's all underground, so it's not as pretty. And then in my own area, the station that was Mount Eden Station, which has been closed for a number of years now, will reopen as Mangafo Station, and that will be, again, another beautiful place to be, but also really transform that area. And we're going to see over the next sort of 15 years a whole bunch of building around the station. At the moment it's a bit of a wasteland, but that's because that land is all going to be sold and developed and create sort of a new precinct through there that's going to be amazing to live in and connect to the existing uptown area in really exciting ways. So it's so exciting, and we've all waited so long and we're just about through the sort of painful gestation, the pregnancy if you like, and we can sort of see the end ahead. We don't know exactly when the first public trains will run, but sometime next year. The focus at the moment and the reason for the test run last week was with a range of mainly central government politicians, actually very few people from council invited. I'm not bitter because I couldn't have gone anyway because of my broken leg. I'm a little bit bitter for some of my colleagues who I know have really championed this project and didn't get a chance to go. But anyway, we have to sort of test and test and test because we have to get this right. It's sort of a test to failure situation at the moment. They're testing to find out what doesn't work so they can fix it, because once we press go, it's going to be all go and we need to get it right. So, super exciting.
I guess maybe could you talk a little bit about the infrastructure pipeline in Auckland and why it is we face so much difficulty in doing these big, scalable infrastructure projects, and what really needs to change in order to be able to deliver high-quality infrastructure on time and on budget?
Yeah, I think that's These are really good questions that we need to grapple with actually as a country, not just a city. Because take, for example, the City Rail Link. That's actually a 50-50 funding split with central government. Central government are a key partner. And actually, when it comes to the really big infrastructure stuff, the size of our country is such that these are actually things that central government needs to be really invested and involved in as well. And so the pipeline of the big mega projects needs buy-in and political certainty from central government. And unfortunately, over recent terms, we've seen a lot of chopping and changing, where the government changes at the central level and suddenly a project that was, you know, these projects take many years to get to spades in the ground, right? And if the sector doesn't have certainty, the construction sector, the sector that does all the prep work and the planning and all of that kind of stuff, if they don't have certainty about, okay, well, we're investing in a project, you know, in its early years, that is going to end up with spades in the ground that we can still be involved in, then the price goes up. And they will look often to projects overseas, well, we've got more certainty about that one. And New Zealand's already an expensive place. You know, we have to import a lot of the, you know, you think about the tunnel boring machines, the crews that went with them. So we've actually had two mega projects underway at the same time, the Central Interceptor, which is a wastewater tunnel being built under Central Auckland, which will be finished, I think, early next year, although the portion in my part of the world is actually finished and is live already, which is great. But you know, we actually had to bring over tunnelling crews to work on both of those projects. A lot of those people have come from the Philippines. They have to relocate their families often for five, you know, or more years. And people are not going to buy into those kinds of projects at a political level, at a contractor level, at a human level, unless there is certainty in that pipeline. And yeah, so light rail is a really good example. We were getting to a point there whether you think the final scheme was the right scheme, underground or at grade or not, we were getting to a point there of, okay, let's press go on the actual next steps of, you know, people will start to see change on the ground. Government changed and that was all off the books again. And so I think one of the big challenges we face is that certainty. Another big challenge is actually how we manage our infrastructure assets. And the Helen Clark Foundation released a really good report on this a couple of months ago called Built to Last. And it was talking about how our asset management of infrastructure is often very poor. And again, it's worse at central government than it is at local government. There's a lot of legal requirements on local government to have asset management plans and things like that, but central government doesn't necessarily have to do those same things. So there's a whole conversation there about infrastructure and getting really serious about some of these big projects and also getting serious about the disruption that they cause for people. At the moment, there's no requirement to compensate, say, a business on a street, say a dairy or something that relies on traffic that goes past it, you know, walking as well as driving or on the bus or whatever, that has roadworks outside of it for a year. There's no requirement in the law. And so the hardship fund that was done for the City Rail Link, that was the first time ever that there's been a hardship fund in the history of New Zealand infrastructure builds. And it was really hard for central government to agree to that. And they did in the end. But there's a whole lot of stuff there that we just don't take seriously about these big infrastructure projects. We're used to small ones. And that's not the future. So how we look at this stuff really needs to change, and how we work together, central and local government, and get those certainty across multiple years, you know, acknowledging these big projects take, you know, the central interceptor was first talked about 40 years ago, and it took 30 years to get spades in the ground, really, and to really commit to it as a project, and it took the amalgamation of all of Auckland's councils to get there. So, it's a huge challenge that we need to stop going, hey, let's do things small and on the cheap and as quickly and get them out of the way, because that's how we end up with things that aren't built to purpose and that we have to patch endlessly. So having some of those bigger ambitions and being able to get political agreement around seeing those through over successive central and local governments is going to be really key.
That's a really interesting point you bring up about how the partnership with central government is an essential component to, you know, building these big, ambitious infrastructure projects. The government is also proposing a rates cap on local councils. Does that hinder, or is that going to hinder, Auckland Council's ability to pitch for larger, ambitious infrastructure projects?
Yeah, I think the rates cap stuff is really interesting because, to me, it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of local government, which is actually not to be subservient to central government, but to play on a different field. And so saying to us, you can only raise so much money through rates, you can only address your funding issues so much through rates, would be a little bit like local government saying to central government, hey, you have to not raise any more money through taxes, you can't change any of your levies. You know, it's actually, I think, an overstep of authority because we are actually supposed to be separate. A little bit like how local boards and the governing body of council are separate. We have separate areas of responsibility, and it would be inappropriate for the governing body of council to say, hey, local board, this local park that you control, we think you've got that all wrong and you should change those fields, say, from football fields to rugby fields in the winter. You know, it's actually like that's not their role and that's not our decision. So it says to me there's a fundamental misunderstanding that they think local government has to be subservient to central government, and it's actually not how it's supposed to be at all. Also, it will be interesting to see how that plays out for Auckland, because actually only 38% of our income comes from rates at the moment. It goes up and down a little bit each year. But that's one of the reasons why Auckland was so much harder hit as a council from COVID, because we didn't have a high proportion of our income from rates. And as a result, we had a massive drop in income that a lot of other councils didn't face. We had to undertake emergency budget decisions that other councils didn't face, which are now, for example, we just had presentations from local boards yesterday who are seeking project money through the Fix and Finish Fund that the Mayor has set up from the sale of the airport shares. And some of them are asking for money that is basic renewal of libraries and community centres, not, you know, building new things or dealing with growth. It's stuff like, you know, hey, the ceiling on this is literally falling down on staff. That goes back to cuts that we had to make in the emergency budget because of COVID. So the financing in local government is a complex machine. We only have a small number of levers. We've been asking central government for more tools, like a return on some of the GST for our region, like being able to do an accommodation targeted rate, so a bed night levy. Central government just keeps saying no. If they then say to us, oh, and by the way, we're going to set an artificial ceiling for how much you can put your rates up by, and it's going to be the same for Horowhenua as it is for Auckland, that's again just undermining actually our role as governors.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on the City Rail Link and the future of infrastructure in Auckland.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
That was Councillor... Oh, sorry, read the wrong thing. We'll be right back. Text 5395. Any of your thoughts on these pieces?
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Auraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
It's only up from here. Picky Picky, the debut album from Geneva AM, is out August 15, and we have copies of the vinyl to give away. Just listen in to 95BFM Breakfast all week and keep your B-card handy for your chance to win. Picky Picky, Picky Picky by Geneva AM. Get your pre-orders today. Album out August 15, wherever good music is found.
Shiny new web series featuring local artists performing two of their own songs and one Kiwi cover.
Hosted by legend Tuva'o Clifton, Season 1 features Phoebe Rings, Soft Bait, Emily Bateman, Jim Nothing, Babe Martin, and Eliza.
B-Sides! New episode dropping every second Wednesday. Watch it now on the 95BFM YouTube channel.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk are go.
Earlier this week, Israel killed 4 Al Jazeera journalists, as well as 2 freelance journalists, in a targeted strike. In total, nearly 270 journalists in Gaza have been killed by Israel since the war began in October 2023. This makes Israel's war on Gaza the deadliest conflict ever for journalists. More journalists have been killed in Gaza than in both world wars, the Vietnam War, the war in Yugoslavia, and the United States war in Afghanistan combined, according to a report published by the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. Last week, I spoke to Assistant Professor in Journalism at Mount Royal University, Gabriela Perdomo-Paez, about the reporting on Gaza from Western media. For International Desk this week, I spoke to her about the danger facing Palestinian journalists on the ground, including from before the current war. I started by asking how concerned she was about Israel targeting journalists in Gaza.
Extremely concerned. I think we should all be. This is not a new event by any means. This is not a new tactic. Israel has been deliberately targeting journalists since before October 7th, but especially since October 7th, we have so many names. We have more than 270 confirmed names of journalists who have been killed by Israel since October 7th, 2023. So yeah, I think we should all be extremely concerned. This is not just an attack on the individual lives of these men and women who have been killed atrociously by Israel's army, but I do think it is absolutely an attack on press freedom, on our own rights to know what is happening on the ground in Gaza. So yeah, I would definitely say that I am extremely and gravely concerned about what's happening.
Do you think journalists in the West owe solidarity to their Palestinian colleagues?
That's such a hard question, because I think everybody has different reasons to react the way they do. And I think, so if you ask me personally, yes, I do think that we owe solidarity to any journalists who are attacked. I think an attack on a journalist is, on a working journalist, on someone who is doing their job, is an attack on journalism, with a capital J. I also think that there are different ways of expressing that solidarity, right? And that solidarity is not just a performance of solidarity, but a demand of, for example, our own governments to do and utilize the tools that they have to prevent this from continuing to happen, right? So that is one way that in which we can show solidarity, right? Like we can speak out, we can offer, of course, our condolences and our solidarity, but you know, like I also think that it's we need to speak out not just after the fact. There's just been too many after the facts, right? So I know that there are journalists organizing though, and there are people all over the world who are doing important work. There's a new organization in Canada, for example. I hope I don't get this wrong, is Canadian Journalists for Justice in Palestine, if I am not wrong. And, you know, it's a group of journalists who have gotten together to precisely exercise pressure, you know, exert pressure on governments to say we need to keep on denouncing these targeted, clearly deliberate attacks on against journalists. So we need to talk about that. And on the other hand, I do think that we need to continue to say this is not something that is happening over there, right? The fact that a legitimately recognized country, a democracy in the way that we understand democracies to be, like a country, its own legitimate forces are carrying attacks against journalists. And that is something that should worry all of us everywhere. You know, like the attacks on journalists, it's not by any means the first country to do that. You know, journalists have worked under duress and under enormous threats everywhere in the world and in many regions for many, many years. This is not new, but of course it should concern us, as it always should in any case. But this is, you know, this is blatant. Like Israel continues to take credit. They actually actively take credit for these attacks. In the most recent attack against the four journalists from Al Jazeera who were killed, Israel took immediate credit for the attack, and it simply justified it as one of the four of them, without any threat of evidence, without showing any evidence. They had accused Anas al-Sharif of being an agent for Hamas and of orchestrating rocket attacks against civilians in Israel, something that they, you know, as they usually do, they say they have proof of it, but they don't show any of the proof. There is no evidence so far that has been presented to support that claim. And that is extremely dangerous, and it should be shocking for anybody working in our profession. So that is something that, yes, absolutely, we should be, we need to be talking about that loud and clear.
Are these journalists able to receive justice for their deaths, even going back to before the war? I'm thinking about the assassination of Shireen Abu Akla, for example.
I don't know that there's any justice after you've been killed, but I do think that many of these journalists asked that we continue our pursuit of the truth, that we continue the pursuit of justice, that we believe them when they are telling us that they are witnessing what they're witnessing, without undermining their claims because they are from a region that we don't understand, for example. You know, we really believe what's happening. They sacrifice their lives bearing witness to something that is happening. If it was not for these journalists, we wouldn't know the atrocities that have been happening on the ground in Gaza, not just after October 7, but since before. There are many, many, many brave journalists who have been telling us about this reality. And maybe if we had paid attention before, we would have been more, you know, more understanding and more nuanced in our understanding of how Israel responded to the October 7th attacks. So I do think that we owe them that. You know, you were talking about what do we owe in terms of solidarity. And I want to say too, I think, you know, this is just a personal opinion, but I do think that everybody, regardless of whether we are journalists or not, I think we owe it to all these journalists to go back and see their reports and listen to the stories that they were trying to tell us and read the reports and watch their videos, because they were putting themselves on the line so that we understood deeply and you know, truthfully what was happening. And I do think that the least we can do right now is listen and really pay attention to what they have been trying to tell us, because, you know, otherwise we're not going to continue. You know, we're going to continue to not put enough pressure on our own governments, on the people who can put a stop on this. If we don't know really what's happening on the ground, we are going to continue to think that we don't have the power to stop it when we do.
Now that Israel has assassinated a large number of Palestinian journalists, what does this mean for the coverage of atrocities in Gaza?
You know, I think every time that one of these journalists is killed, we lose an enormous amount of information, an enormous amount of context for what's happening. What's going to happen is that some other incredibly brave people are going to continue to tell us what's happening, even if they are increasingly under, you know, the threat of famine themselves. You know, we know from news organizations who are telling us our own journalists are starving themselves. So many of these individual journalists are telling us, like, we have run out of energy, of calories. We can't even continue to do that. So what's going to happen is that, you know, it's just a continuation of how horribly misinformed and underinformed we have been about this conflict. And that's just going to continue to silence. I don't know how much longer we can go, or they can go, you know. we are okay, but the people in Gaza are not okay. And really the worst possible thing that can happen is that we are going to stop receiving news on the ground.
That was Assistant Professor in Journalism at Mount Royal University, Gabriella Perdomo-Paez, on Israel's targeted attacks on Palestinian journalists.
International Desk on 95BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
This week, the Dental for All campaign set out on a national roadshow to build public support over communities across the country. The campaign team stands for universal, free, and tertiary-consistent dental health care that is delivered through our public health care system. Under the current system, individuals above the age of 18 have to access dental health care privately, or those in need can apply for a WINS grant of $1,000, which is strictly means-tested. This often means that those who do not qualify for the grant simply do not access dental health care. According to public polling carried out in 2022, 74% of the public supports the idea of universal dental health care. The campaign is trying to make the case to communities across the country so that they can get the buy-in necessary from political leaders going into the 2026 election next year. I wanted to get more insight into what the campaign team sees as its road to victory on this issue and whether this is a feasible proposal. So I talked to Dental for All campaigner Hannah Pilkington-Ching about her work. I was wondering if you could just give me a quick overview of the Dental for All campaign and the roadshow that you guys are currently embarking on.
Kia ora, thanks for having me on. So the Dental for All campaign is calling for adult dental care to be brought into our public health system and made free for everyone. And we're also calling for our oral health system to uphold Te Tiriti Te o Waitangi. And so we're just heading off on a roadshow this week to go all over the country holding community events about the Dental for All kaupapa to build awareness and build a strong movement that can help make Dental for All a political reality.
So currently in the public health care system, some dental health care is covered, correct, for certain groups?
Yeah, so we currently have free dental care for under 18s as part of the public health system. But as soon as you hit 18, you move out of home, maybe you go study and there's just basically no support in the public system. We do have a WINS grant, which is very strictly means tested, and that can give you $1,000 for urgent dental care. But that really captures just a really small portion of the population that actually need that support to access dental care. We actually have nearly half of adults in Aotearoa report unmet dental need due to cost in the past year. And we also know that those rates are higher for young people, Māori, Pacifica, and people with disabilities. We basically just have emergency dental care in the hospital. So if something's so bad that you end up coming through ED, we have that very specific WINS grant, which is quite difficult to access for a lot of people, and basically nothing else. It doesn't really make sense when we know that oral health is part of the rest of our health, and it doesn't really make sense to carve out the teeth from the rest of our body in our public system.
Dental for All promise seems to be far more expensive than just improving the current means-tested system. Could you speak to a little bit about why maybe a universal system is better and how we could potentially afford that?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of what we're talking about with this campaign is the flaws of a means-tested system, because what this WINS grant is supposed to do, or at least what it says it does, is provide, financial support to people that need it to access urgent dental care. But the reality is that so many people who desperately need that support can't access it because it's a really intense and degrading process to have to go to WINS, to have then look through your bank statements and have to prove your neediness. A lot of people, report having a very small amount of savings in their account, which they actually, they need that safety net, but that meaning that they're not eligible for the WINS grant. And we also know that in general, means-tested systems are actually more resource-intensive to maintain because there's a lot of public service work that needs to go into, figuring out who supposedly needs that service or not. Another point I'd make around the value of a universal system is that we have other universal services like most of the rest of our health system, you know, primary and secondary education. We also have superannuation. So we have some examples of free public services, which we all kind of agree are just, I guess, providing basic rights, which we should all be able to access basic education, basic healthcare for free. And it doesn't, you know, no one questions, oh, why should people be getting the superannuation who don't need it? Why should, you know, because there's actually buy-in from all of us when we all benefit from a system. It's more likely to last politically because everyone benefits from it, and it's harder to, I guess, you know, carve away sections of it over time and start to blame the people that benefit from that system when it's something that we all have access to. So, yeah, those are some of the reasons why we think it's really important to move to a universal model for dental care in alignment with other parts of our health system.
So are there examples maybe overseas of universal dental healthcare systems?
We are currently working on a report which looks at this, looks at examples of, yeah, countries overseas that have more access to dental care. Yeah, some of the countries we're looking at have, I guess, more of a public system. We also know that we know that would work. We know it would work here in Aotearoa, and we're, I guess, trying to develop the ambition here to, yeah, develop a system which is grounded in Te Tiriti and is based on the evidence about oral health being an important part of the rest of our healthcare. But yeah, some of the examples we're looking at overseas include places where there's more like in some areas local government service provision. There's also some insurance-based models such as in Japan where there's much better access to dental care. There's also the NHS. So, yeah, we're looking at some of those examples to, I guess, inform our policy options here. But, yeah, we also believe that, we already know that oral health is important to the rest of our health, and there are some really legitimate ways that that could be better integrated into our public health system. And I guess we shouldn't hold back our ambition for that, because of needing to see those examples from overseas either.
Could you maybe elaborate on what a Te Tiriti-informed system like this would look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So like with other areas of our public services, the Crown has an obligation to uphold Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And one thing that means is, I guess, enabling and allowing and supporting Māori to have tinoranga tiritanga over Māori health. And so within the dental system, some ideas about how that could look is the government resourcing Māori to have authority over the future of Māori oral healthcare and what that model looks like, resourcing iwi, hapu and marae-based services or Māori oral health providers, and also, extending whānau order delivery model to include dental in that. So we believe that those things are really important to happen alongside dental care being free for everyone as part of the public system.
Can you maybe walk me through what the roadmap for the campaign is, what you envision your pathway to victory on this issue being, and what some of the roadblocks might be on the way?
Yeah, so we've done some research. So I guess research is sort of one area of work that we do. Last year we released a report which looks at the economics of the current system and what it's costing us currently for adults to not be able to access dental care in terms of the impact on the rest of our society. And we've also done some more research on, which focuses on people's lived experience with the dental system and research which kind of shares people's stories of the barriers that they face and the impacts that has on their lives. And then as mentioned, we have this report coming up looking at what we can learn from oral health systems overseas. Also some work exploring what tinoranga tiritanga over oral health care means. So those are some of the things in the works in the research space. We also think it's really important that there's a really strong public mandate for dental for all. I mean, we know that 7 in 10 New Zealand adults actually support bringing adult dental care into the public system. So there is that baseline support also across the political spectrum in the public. But obviously this is it's a shift to what the system currently is, and so we need to, demonstrate that support to our political leaders and build a sense of urgency and power in that movement so that it is, a really easy decision for our political leaders to make to pick up this policy and run with it. Particularly with this roadshow next year and some of our work over the next year, we're leading up to next year's general election, and our hope is that free, universal and Te Tira Te Waitangi consistent dental care will be a key issue at that election, and that will have, multiple political parties coming through with, I guess, bold proposals about what that could look like, that we can hold them accountable to, hopefully in the next government. So that's a little bit of our political direction, and I guess part of why we're going on this roadshow now is to build up that engagement and local organising groups around the country to enable that to happen throughout the next year.
That was Dental for All campaigner Hannah Pilkington-Cheng on a recent roadshow and the feasibility of Dental for All.
So around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is Author Tahi from Mokotron.
Oh.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The government has recently announced changes to the National GP funding formula, which aims to better resource GP offices across the country with funding that is more reflective of the communities they serve. This formula had previously not been changed for the last 20 years and has faced calls for substantial reform. A recent report found that the introduction of morbidity, social deprivation, and ethnicity data into this formula would lead to more equitable health outcomes. The government has included most of these recommendations, but has specifically excluded ethnicity data from this formula, even though the government has previously acknowledged that ethnicity does play a role in determining health outcomes if evidence exists. Extensive epidemiological evidence from the past 30 years demonstrates the need for healthcare of Maori and Pacific populations is very high, and is driven not just by poverty, but also by the added disadvantages those communities face in New Zealand society. Life expectancy, for example, is 7 years less for Maori and 6.9 years less for Pacific people, compared with people who identify with European or other ethnicities. I talked to the University of Otago's Dr. Gabriel McDonald on these changes to the formula and why it is so important to include ethnicity data. I was wondering if you could very briefly walk me through what the GP funding formula is and also what changes the government has recently proposed to that formula.
Kia ora, Sinat. Thanks for having me. So a GP funding formula is how primary care services in New Zealand are allocated money. So for the last 20 or so years, that has been based on the enrolled patients with a particular GP practice. So they're not funded for who actually comes and sees them on a daily basis, but actually who's enrolled in the practice. And you can take those enrolments and look at the characteristics of the population and allocate funding on that basis. So funding in that way is trying to encourage primary prevention and for general practices to look after their whole population. So it was a different way to how we funded in the 20th century. So this formula is designed to allocate money based on the patient population. And we've been using the same one for the last 20 years. And there have been various calls to update it because it was only based on the age and sex of the patients who were enrolled with that population. And we know that there are other factors that have an influence in health need, more so or in addition to age and sex. So that's what the formula is. And as I said, there have been calls over the years for the formula to be updated to include more things than just age and sex. And so that was done a couple of years ago. A report was commissioned and that did quite an in-depth analysis on what a better formula would look like. And that formula, or that analysis, found that as well as age and sex, including ethnicity, socioeconomic deprivation, so that's a measure of poverty, and morbidity, which is people's pre-existing health conditions, could all be put into the formula and would produce a much better measure that's correlated with health need.
So the idea is that by changing the data that we input into this formula about who actually is using the GP services, we can better allocate funding to those communities that need it more. Is that correct?
Well, it's about looking at the population who's enrolled in you.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the ones who come to see you, because they're not always the ones that need the most healthcare. But it's about using as much information as we can to sensibly allocate our very scarce health dollars.
In your article, you talk about how this new formula remains incomplete because it leaves out ethnicity data. Can you talk a little bit about how ethnicity plays into diverse health needs across New Zealand's communities?
Sure. So we've got a health system that serves the European majority moderately well and doesn't serve Māori and Pacific communities as well as it does for the European population. And so at every step, Māori experience and Pacifica people experience barriers, either in their own risk to health even before
they get to a doctor, and then in accessing a doctor and being referred on in terms of the interventions they receive, and outcomes are usually worse for Māori and Pasifika than they are for Europeans who experience privilege in that position. So we know that this exists, and we need to reorientate our system to do better for people and to reduce that level of privilege that is experienced by some and not by others.
There's been a vein of rhetoric from the government over multiple proposals, and I suppose that public services should not be determined, or the level of public service that an individual gets should not be determined by their ethnicity or their race, that these decisions should be purely colorblind. Is that something you agree with? Is that something that is principled, or is that leading us down further worsening decisions and outcomes?
I think statements like that make an assumption that we're not colorblind to start with, and we know that that's just not true. So if you want to talk about fairness, which is essentially what that is claiming to be, is to be fair, then we need to completely orientate our system so it's fair to begin with. So you can't logically make a statement like that without looking at how uncolourblind the system is currently. It's an unhelpful rhetoric, especially when we know that ethnicity is actually a very good indicator of need. So we're not privileging one type of person over another for no reason. We're trying to redress the underlying deficit that our system has with regard to certain people, and make things more fair. It's completely justified and based in evidence. And rhetoric that says we need to treat everyone equally would be great if we did that to begin with, but we know that we don't.
And in your mind, what are you looking for from the government when it comes to a GP funding formula?
Oh, look, following the evidence would be really great. They've been given this very in-depth analysis. It's a good quality report. And if they followed that, that would be really good.
That was the University of Otago's Dr. Gabrielle MacDonald on why ethnicity data should be included in the GP funding formula.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Carmel Cipollone, Mount Royal University's Gabriella Perdomo-Paez, Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry, Dental for All campaigner Hannah Pilkington-Ching, and the University of Otago's Dr. Gabrielle MacDonald. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia. Thank you.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.